Welcome to the Wright Family Law Divorce Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Wright, attorney, author, entrepreneur, and motivational speaker. This is the Wright Family Law Divorce Podcast. Let's get started. Hi, welcome to the Wright Family Law Divorce Podcast, episode number 20. So excited today to have Katie Cooperman, who is the author of The Only Way Out. Amazing to have you with us, Katie. She is the author of a heart-wrenching and inspiring fiction novel for youth and young adults about bullying, mental health, and really the power of words and how it affects kids and families today in 2024. I'm so excited to have you with us. Katie is an author, a copywriter, and an entrepreneur based in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and who is a passionate writer. She feels so strongly about bullying and mental health and cyberbullying and internet safety and all of these things that are so heavily affecting the youth today. I'm excited to dive in. Katie, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm truly honored to be here.
Katie, let's start off with what inspired you to write The Only Way Out and why you chose bullying and mental health as central themes in this novel.
Yes. So I will tell you that, you know, when I really started out in my career, I was doing a lot of writing for clients. I ran a writing business. And for years, for the better part of a decade, even a little beyond that, I was helping clients bring their stories to life in so many different ways. And that really, I think, spawned my passion for bringing my own story to life. The problem was in the beginning, I had absolutely no idea what that story should be. I knew I wanted to write a book. I didn't know what I wanted to write about. That is until one day I came across Amanda Todd and her story. Mm. So she is a late BC teenager. She's no longer with us, unfortunately. She has a tale that is extremely heart-wrenching. And it pulled on my own heartstrings. And I remember I was at the gym when I sort of came across this video. She put up a very powerful video on YouTube that had these flashcards. And she wasn't saying any words, but she was just moving through these flashcards. And it was just her words written down of everything she was going through and everything she was struggling with, which included relentless bullying, sextortion. You know, this horrible predator had found her, had lured her in, and then also followed her wherever she went. So even though she tried to change her life and move schools, he found her, found her friends. Mm. It's a pretty terrible story. It moved me to tears that day on the elliptical. Mm. And I've always been an anti-bullying advocate for as long as I can remember. Even back when I was in grade school or high school, there really wasn't a lot of it, to be honest, around me. But I was always conscious of people being treated unfairly or people not being treated with the level of kindness or fairness that they deserve. And so when I came across this story, I was so deeply moved. I knew that I wanted to, it was in that moment, I just knew I wanted to write a story about bullying. And I started writing that very day, I remember. And I thought, I'm going to make it a fictional tale and I'm going to just let my journey take me through. I didn't really outlined the book right off the bat. I thought, let me just see where this takes me. Mm. And it's a very powerful experience. And it was within that writing journey that I ended up going into the mental health spaces. I didn't really know that I was going to go there. And it's interesting that I did now that I think back, because today the two, they don't always, but they often go hand in hand. And I think there is a link there that we all must recognize. Mm. And so it is my hope and my vision with this book that I can move my readers to the point that they feel aware of the possibilities of what can happen, mm. that they feel also empowered with the strength of their own words and how they choose to use them.
So the novel talks about two young women, Caitlin and Rebecca. Can you give us sort of like a summary of the novel without giving too much away?
Absolutely. So it does follow the lives of these two best friends as they enter high school together. And so they enter their first year and it isn't long before they have an altercation. They're together at this point with a bully, let's call her, another girl at the school. It is sort of a bullying incident that was, you know, completely unnecessary, but also nothing too major at that point. And so they kind of carry on about their lives. And then there's another thing that happens, and then another thing that happens. And essentially, Rebecca goes, she's the one that finds herself the target of this, who has become relentless bully, but the reader doesn't know that all the way through, how relentless it really is.
Mm-hmm.
And it leads Rebecca to hold a number of secrets, even from those closest to her. And it isn't until a larger tragedy takes place that those secrets become revealed. And it then sends Caitlin into a world of guilt and accountability. And she finds herself a bystander, and she wants to be there for her friend, but her friend doesn't want her to use her voice. Her friend is ashamed. So there's all these dynamics that I feel many young adults find themselves in, one of these situations sometimes, right, or at certain times. And so there's this dark side to the book. But then, you know, in the latter half, it's all about Caitlin realizing that she cannot stay silent about what has happened. And that if she uses her voice in certain ways, that it is opening up the story of Rebecca, and it's using that story to teach others. Mm-hmm. And it's forcing other people around in the community, in the school, and so forth, to stand up for what isn't fair and for what should not happen. None of us should have to go through this kind of stuff.
No, never. Now, how do you think family dynamics specifically play a role in how young women like Caitlin and Rebecca cope with bullying and mental health issues?
So I love this question, because I feel so strongly about a strong family foundation. And by that, I'm going to focus in one particular area. I think there's so many different avenues of that. But in one particular area, which I have actually seen time and time again now, either through friends or through myself, I'm also a parent, and, you know, my children are starting to get a little bit older now. And one thing that I've believed in since day one is the power of communication within a family. Mm. And by that, I mean an attitude, an open and accepting attitude, an open door policy. So that kids always know, whether they're the age of one and they smashed a plate somewhere, or they're the age of 18 and they're going through something very serious and difficult to talk about, and maybe they're even ashamed to admit that they feel certain ways. If as a family, as a whole family unit, we can create this open door policy, this open line of communication,
mm-hmm,
then I strongly believe that even if our children still struggle in certain ways, which they absolutely will, we're all growing. Even as adults, we still struggle in certain areas.
Right.
If we feel that we have the people closest to us to still accept us, to still love us, and most importantly, to talk things through with us, mm-hmm, no matter what it is that we're experiencing, there is so much power in that. We won't feel alone. We won't feel isolated. We won't feel as though we have nowhere else to turn, which then leads us into the next segue, which is families and the strong dynamics of open communication,
mm-hmm,
can help children and families as a unit get to the next step, whatever that may be. The first step is the open and honest communication. And the next step is maybe a further solution. I'm not saying words are everything, but they are the first step. And we have to get to the first step in order to get to any more meaningful change that the child or anyone else in the family, mm-hmm, needs in order to overcome the obstacle.
I think it's so, the communication piece, honestly, and in terms of the family core, right? I mean, and I've had a case or two where this is actually almost to a crisis level with children's mental health, tweens, teens, where, you know, you've got parents who can't communicate, right? They can't even get on the same page. They're fighting over parenting time. They have completely disparate ideas about how a child should be parented or guided or directed. I mean, they can't even agree upon the fundamentals, and they're so hell-bent on making war against each other. They're completely oblivious to the world that their teen is in, right? Outside of that conflict, they're dealing with the peer pressure, the social media issues, the pressure to conform, you know, all of it. And it's only until things reach a crisis that it's like, oh my gosh, you know, can we even now salvage any piece of positive communication to try to get this child's mental health trajectory back on track. I'll tell you real quick. I had a case where mom and dad, they're just at war. And they had a teenage son who's around age 15, age 16, who was a victim of a hazing incident in high school.
Yes.
And, you know, there was a little bit of parental alienation going on. You know, there was a lot in play there. But in the middle of the family court war, he just started to take a spiral down. Now, it's not as if the parents didn't get the appropriate remedies in place. Like the boy was going to therapy, you know, he had sort of a life coach and some other things, but he wasn't communicating. He wasn't, you know, talking to mom, dad. I mean, he would give off little hints here and there to the therapist, but right around Thanksgiving, he made threats of self-harm. And the next thing you know, he's hospitalized. He was there over the holidays. And it was like, oh my gosh, how did we even get to this point? And that speaks to the communication. Parents need to communicate. They've got to bury that hatchet, whatever it is, you know, and focus on the best interests of the child. So, so, so important. Now, let's talk about a minute about the impact of social media on the bullying and the mental health among teenagers and, you know, how family law might address these issues. And in family court, you know, sometimes parents are very like hands off, you know, let, you know, give, you know, a kid their freedom. They should have free reign on the social media. We want to give them their privacy and let them be young adults and sort of live life as it comes. And then you've got parents on sort of the other end of the spectrum that are like, all right, parental controls, screen time, let's monitor this. You know, at what age, you know, in your mind, do you think, you know, where do we segue off of that whole social media thing? I mean, it's so dangerous, you know, I mean.
It really is.
What do you think?
It scares me half to death.
Yeah.
Just because I was reading a particular article recently that put it so nicely. Even as adults, we were handed this technologically powerful tool that none of us had ever seen before.
Right.
And as adults, you look around, adults can't even manage this tool effectively.
Yeah. Right.
Most of us cannot. You know, I've heard many adults talk about how they're addicted to this using that term too. I'm addicted to this platform. I have deleted my account. I can't handle it. And these are all certain things maybe as adults we can see, whoa, what am I doing here? And how am I spending the majority of my day glued with my head down on my smartphone and you know, getting glimpses into other people's lives who I maybe don't even know, don't care about. You know, you get into that whole, the thing that scares me a lot too is the comparison piece. Yeah. So I feel great today. I'm having a wonderful day. I'm 14 years old and everything is great at home and I'm happy. And I'm doing great at school. You know, I got a B, I got an A. And then all of a sudden you go on social media and you've got some other 14-year-old posting about how they're a superstar at this sport or they're going to the Olympics or I'm just giving up random examples.
Right.
All of a sudden your personal greatness has been diminished by someone else's completely separate life, has nothing to do with yours.
Right. So
the comparison piece, I think, is a big element of danger. Another element is what I'll call the addiction piece, where sometimes you don't even realize it. You're on there, something distracts you. You actually completely forget about your surroundings. Was I supposed to go pack my bag for soccer? Was I supposed to go finish homework? I'm now on my phone and I'm just in it. I'm just scrolling. And you know, these social media outlets are designed to make you do that. They scroll certain things. They follow your interests. They follow your likes. They follow your algorithms to then feed you more and more to keep you on there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to start educating our children at a really young age, just that this is possible and not to shame them, not to say, if you do this for too many hours a day, you will become addicted to this device. Not like that, but more in the sense of we are all as human beings trying to figure out this technology still to this day.
Right.
We have to manage it. Let's manage it together. You know, teaching them the risks, I think, is really important, even from a young age. Not so much detail, but maybe just saying and reiterating the fact that, you know, once you post something on social media or anywhere online, it is there forever. I think that's a concept that many kids, teens, tweens, they don't fully understand that concept of forever. And it's an important one when it comes to social media. So I think there are proactive and positive ways to teach our kids yes, this can be a great tool. You can also learn a lot from social media. There's lots of informational pieces out there. You might get an idea of how to cook something differently, or, you know, there's so many positive aspects to it. So I think completely instilling all the fear isn't the right way either, but it can positive management around this powerful tool. So how much time should we spend on this today? What do you think? Ask for their opinion. Make that child feel important in that decision. You might be surprised at their answer. You might be thinking 1 hour and maybe they're going to tell you 30 minutes. And you can say, that's very fair. Okay, let's do that. And let's set a timer if we need to. Also, you know, what is it that you want to do on there once they get older and they want, if they have their own social media accounts, maybe asking them those questions of, why do you want that account? What is it that you're going to be posting about? And what do you like to see on there?
Right.
Just to make sure, is it healthy? You know, are we having a healthy relationship with this tool, or could it lead down a dark road?
Right.
So again, going back to that communication, coming up with a plan together that you feel is fair as a parent, also that your child feels is fair, because they're just going to rebel against you if they feel that it's not fair.
Right.
Coming up with that fair plan to manage.
Yeah, no matter how you slice this pie, it comes back to that communication piece. I mean, that's just the fundamental. In the terms of your book, let's reflect on the importance of communication for a minute. When we're talking about families and a child who's caught up in all of these mixed messages that they're getting from social media, from their peers, from maybe the educators, let's talk about the importance of it. Where on a scale of 1 to 10 on the spectrum, how important is it in terms of the novel? Could communication with these girls, with Caitlin and Rebecca's parents, could things have taken a different trajectory?
Yes. So I would say the importance of it, 12.
Right.
It's that important. I think in the novel itself, in this story, I know that, and that is the whole message, is that there is this realization that, if one of us had spoken up sooner, if one of us had followed our gut. So the main character, Caitlin, she wants to tell someone what's going on. She's realized a couple things on the surface, and she approaches Rebecca and said, you know, as a best friend, and says, let me help you. Let's go tell our parents. Let's tell the school principal. Let's tell our teachers. Let's tell the guidance counselors, whoever you want to tell, but let's go start telling people so we can fix this, what's going on. And Rebecca is scared and so ashamed, and the fear of what might happen to her because of the bully's focus on her in that part of the book makes her say to her best friend, no, you cannot do this. You need to trust me on this. I want to just forget about what happened. I need to move on. I need to not think about this anymore. Please don't you dare tell a single soul. It's going to be fine. And unfortunately, you know, this is a very real dynamic. There's the power and the loyalty of friendship in that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, think about yourself as a best friend of someone in your life. And that friend, whatever they told you is, you know, please don't tell anyone that I have told you this. This has to be the secret between us. Maybe it's a perfectly harmless secret, and in which case that's fine, of course. But in this case, it's not harmless. It's extremely harmful. And the problem with bullying is that it often does escalate and it does not stop. There has to be the open dialogue, not only among friends, but then the next step, which is the scariest step. But even if it's just a parent, then let them do the next scary part. You don't have to do that next scary part. Even if it's not a parent, maybe it's a cousin, maybe it's a guidance counselor, maybe it's an anonymous. There are lots of places that you can call, you know, to get that help. And many of them, if you get the right one, they can then liaise with the school if it's happening there, liaise with law, liaise with the police to take it to the next step that it should be taken to. But communication and telling at least someone right away is the most important. That's the only way that it's going to stop.
Right. Let's talk about the role of schools and educators in partnership with families and even family law professionals like myself when it comes to combating the bullying. Now, the way I see it, and maybe you might have a different perspective, seems like, you know, within the past 10, 15 years, as bullying awareness has, you know, increased, you know, you see more schools teaching kindness, inclusivity, sort of like these $50 buzzwords. It almost seems like the more we try to push this ideology of kindness and love and all of these positive things, it's almost like the bully, it seems to be getting worse. And I half wonder if, you know, we're preaching these messages to these kids, yet on the internet and social media, you know, they just become so desensitized to, you know, unkindness, to sort of like bad behavior, whether it's violence or sex. You know, there's just a total lack of really like a moral compass. You know, we're sort of saying one thing to them in school and maybe at home, but when we expose them or let them loose on the internet or social media, they're seeing something totally different. So how do you reconcile that, especially when we're talking about schools and educators and administrators reinforcing that message in today's day and age?
Yeah, that is such a good question. You know, this conflicting and almost if there's too much of that in their face, you know, be kind, be kind, be kind. Do they then sort of say, yeah, be kind. We know. But do they really understand what that means in every different scenario? I think that's part of it as well, right? So I think from an education standpoint, less focus on the kindness, more focus on recognizing certain situations and how to handle yourself in all of those different situations. So, you know, at one school that I recently did a talk at, the principal was telling me that sometimes these days she's finding that the kids in her school, and particularly the younger ones, are calling an incident bullying when really it didn't happen over and over and over again. It wasn't relentless. It wasn't repeated. And all it was a friend kind of said something a little bit rude to them, but they will come out and say, that was bullying. And the principal was telling me how she's trying to educate. What's the difference between bullying and conflict? Right. Or bullying and rudeness? But, you know, there is a key distinction to be made there. And so I think part of the education, it's not one simple solution, but I think more of a more rounded approach to discuss these different things. So talking about the difference between those different avenues and those different situations that can come up in our lives, bullying versus conflict, bullying versus rudeness, you know, mental health versus just having a bad day. You know, we need to define these things a little bit better, I believe, for our youth. Further to that, it has to be also a zero tolerance attitude, which I believe could be part of the missing piece. I think that more schools and more educators were reaching out more actively to parents, family law professionals such as yourself, the local community, the principal, everyone was involved and faster. So some of the stories that I hear also are, oh yeah, this happened. We're still waiting for so-and-so to be assigned to the case so that we can get justice. So, you know, a little bit quicker. I don't know if that's such an easy solution.
Right. Right.
Faster and more of this holistic approach. It's not going to be one simple lesson. It's not going to be one thing that somebody says, but the zero tolerance attitude, the open and honest communication in the classroom, you know, if teachers can create units that discuss these things in a more, you know, collaborative way, that's not threatening. It's not a teacher at the front of the classroom stating facts, teaching a lesson. And, you know, you kind of lose the kids maybe a little bit. They're listening to some, not listening to others. How can we get through to them in a different way?
Right.
Part of the vision for my book as well. My book is currently being read by over 300 grade 9 students, and they are loving it and they are resonating with it. And they are reaching out to me and stating how realistic they're finding the story and how they're learning from it and feeling empowered in their own voices. That's the most rewarding thing for me as an author. But, you know, maybe that's a piece of it, just teaching them in different ways. How can we get through to them and through to their emotions so that they're motivated to make small, meaningful changes? And maybe that means you don't say the rude thing to your friend. You caught yourself in that moment. You know, spreading this sort of non-bullying attitude in many different ways throughout the course of your life and your everyday.
Yeah. And that's amazing. 300 grade 9 students. all reading the book together. That's incredible. And I think peer support and intervention go hand in hand with that. When you've got like a big group of students that are reading the book together, they're sort of digesting the themes together. How important is the role of peer support and intervention in the scenarios that you talk about? And how can families encourage that? I think required reading, I mean, for like maybe an English class to adopt this novel in as like required reading, or like an option, right? For required reading, either summer reading or during the school year, would just be fantastic. I hope if there's like maybe some English teachers, some high school English teachers or literature professors who are listening to this, that might consider
be great.
on this novel for their students. But let's talk about the role of peer support and intervention in the scenarios that we're talking about. And how can families in particular encourage peer support and intervention?
Yeah, I love that. You know, I think one of the big messages around the whole communication piece that I like to bring into everything that I do, including the school talks that I do, I have this visual where I use building blocks and I talk about the fact that each and every one of us on this earth, we're all just a single block. Mm-hmm. And all of these building blocks are different shapes and sizes. We all look different. None of us is the same. And yet when we come together, you know, I do this sort of visual with the blocks and they're built up into these towers. And then I bring the towers together to form this one connected community because we are stronger together. There's that old mentality and that old kind of story. You know, do you think if a whole mob bus full of students stood up to a bully and told that bully to stop, do you think they could fight through that? You know, if we stand together, we have much more power.
Right.
And I know that that's very difficult. And just especially depending on the grade that you're in, the situation, nobody is saying that any of this is easy. But if we do have this mentality of together and not separated, a lot more can take place. You know, if a child feels they can go to their friends and not be made fun of and that the friends will stick up for them or tell someone or maybe get a group of them to make a change, there's no easy answer. But I think even starting at home in the classroom, if we can instill that sense of community, we're all in this together.
Right.
You know, that feeling of no one's alone. We're in this together. We're in class together. We're a family together. We are all here for you the same way you're here for me.
Right.
And just that whole mentality of togetherness and community versus I have to battle everything on my own. You know, it's the same. Even think about business life, right? Sometimes we go through these turbulent roadmaps and we're thinking, oh, I got to figure this all out alone. But what if we could do it together?
Together. It's so true. And teenagers in particular, you know, they often feel like they don't have a lot of social capital. Like here I am, you know, I feel like I don't have a lot of friends, or the friends that I do have, they don't have a lot of social capital either. But what you don't have zero social capital. You might not have a lot, but you have some. And when everyone pulls what they have together, you know, you can overcome the threat. You know, like you say, the mob situation on the bus with the bully. You know, everyone might not have much social capital, but if we pull what we have, we can be a force for good. I mean, it's so true. But again, it comes down with the teens. You know, it's all their perception sort of directs the ship in so much. And you perceive is not necessarily reality.
That's so true.
And it's so hard. Let's talk about balancing the portrayal of difficult subjects like bullying, mental health, with hope and resilience in this story. You know, you talk about sort of the first half of the novel is sort of dark with these events sort of unfolding as they do with Rebecca. But in the second half, how we sort of have hope. Let's talk about, you know, the positive side of this.
Yeah.
Corey.
Which is such an important part. It's the most important part. And that's another, you know, key lesson, I believe, for families in the classroom, everywhere in life. If we can raise our kids to feel that they are capable to face any situation that comes their way, no matter how difficult, their doors are always open. There is endless possibility there. It's the child who feels hopeless, alone, isolated, no way out, that feels as though they cannot overcome certain things that come their way that, granted, might be exceedingly difficult even for anybody to comprehend or understand. But if we can teach that resilience, and that starts, again, from such a young age, it becomes a habit at home. And it's sometimes it's so little, right? When it comes to resilience or believing in yourself, if you just think about your life, right? The little times that might stick in your head about that coach who told you, great job, that was exceptional.
Yeah.
Or the teacher pulled you aside and said, thank you so much for being so helpful in the classroom today. Or the thing's so much more simple than that. You know, you went to the store, and I always remember Gary Vee talking about this, that his mother, you know, he was 9 and he opened the door for this older lady to walk through the door ahead of them. And his mom, you know, stopped him after that and grabbed his shoulders and shook him and said, I am so proud of you. That was incredible. You know, I think as parents, sometimes we spend too much time on the rules, the chores, the responsibilities, and raising kids that way. But what about bigging them up? What about making them feel as though they are on the top of the world? We have to tell our children they are amazing every day. We have to tell them they can do anything that they put their minds to every day. We have to tell them they are capable, that they are worthy, that they are, that they should be willing to learn and willing to rise up in any scenario.
Right. Listen, when it comes to raising kids, it's a daily battle. The rent is due and the rent is due. You don't get to take a day off. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. You know, and with the in the family court in particular, you know, with the teenagers, the resilience piece really suffers. You know, when they get sort of a spark and hope, or maybe I could say something, maybe I could speak up. What they say to one parent, right, they may be concerned that my parent, my mother or my father might use that as leverage against the other parent, or somehow what that teen is going through, right? One parent is going to get blamed. Well, if mom didn't do this or didn't parent that way, or they allowed this to happen, you know, it upsets the parenting time or the custody piece, or it's somehow going to be brought up in front of a judge, right? Now, we tell family court litigants, family court topics stay in the family court. You do never, ever, ever discuss family court litigation with your child. Why? Because it is extremely detrimental to their mental health. They're shouldering enough as teens with the social pressure and everything that they're going through that is too much of a burden for them to carry. But do parents do it? Yes, they do. Do they do it anyway? Unfortunately, they do. And proving it, of course, is very difficult. I mean, in the context of family court and he said, she said, and this is hearsay and what have you. Now, the blame game, right? Having a parent taking a fall for a child speaking up and trying to explain a situation that's going on in their life just adds another level of complexity to these already complicated mental health struggles that these kids are going through. Now, in your mind, what are some of the signs that parents who are going through a divorce or family court litigation should watch for in their kids that might indicate one way or another bullying or some other mental health struggle? And when is it, you know, time to take action?
Yeah. Great question. So one of the key ones is seclusion. So if you notice your child is all of a sudden very secluded, maybe goes to their room more, doesn't want to sit around and be together the way they were before. That's one sign. Another sign is if you do see them on their phone, but then when you come around, they instantly try to put the phone away as though they're hiding something. Mm-hmm. There could be something going on social media or even in chat rooms or anything of that sort through the phone. Number three, a more simple one, any real change in your child's sort of regular behavior could be an indicator of something going on. I think that, you know, if you ask specific questions of the parent, I feel like you get better answers as a kid from your child usually. So if you are asking in general, how was your day? We all know you're not going to get much, you know, but remembering something specific that was going to go on that day, perhaps at school or wherever they are, and then asking about that specific thing will often get them talking. So be more specific with your questions. And remember the things that they've told you other days of what's going on so that you can kind of keep tabs that way. But again, you know, back to the communication piece is another big sign. So any real big reluctance to talk, to tell you about anything that's going on, even if sometimes they might say, I don't want to tell you, I don't want to talk about this, that could be a bit of a red flag of something bigger going on as well. And I think when it comes to when is it time to take further action, a parent needs to follow their gut. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, especially it's so hard to say, you know, as you're going through one of the most difficult times of your life, if it is in the middle of a divorce, for example, you know, with family law, I can't imagine how difficult that is as you're also trying to raise an incredible teenager. But, you know, following your gut, trying not to be too wrapped up in the case. And again, I know that's exceedingly difficult to do. It's easier to say, but remembering that there is this other piece around you. So still trying to stay as involved as you can in your teen's life or in your child's life, and always making them know that you love them and this has nothing to do with them and so forth. And just keeping those lines of communication open so that if something is going on, that they will feel they can talk to you. And you have to follow your gut when it comes to taking the next step. I think as all parents, we have that little piece of intuition. You know, we're connected to our children in those special ways and with that bond. So if you feel even there's the slightest maybe, then perhaps go take that next step, because sometimes it's, you would never want to look back and say, I didn't do it soon enough, or it was too late and it got to this point, like that story that you told earlier.
Yeah. I mean, and even that taking that next step, I mean, that in and of itself is a complicated challenge. I did another podcast episode last year about, you know, should I force my teenager to go to therapy? Right. Mm-hmm. That alone is a loaded question.
Yes.
You know, I mean, maybe they'll voluntarily go. Maybe you're going to get a fight. How do you negotiate the terms of that? Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if they're being secretive, you know, you won't talk to me. Well, then you're going to have to talk to someone else. You know, it's time to go to therapy. I mean, what are you going to do? Hog tie and stuff them in the car? I mean, that in and of itself, I mean, is just a whole mountain of potential problems that are just waiting to come down. But, you know, again, it seems like, you know, the more questions you try to answer with this topic, it's like the more just pop up. You know, it's one of these things that there is never, ever, ever an easy solution. All we can do is sort of try to address it on a case by case situation. And again, just keep encouraging that communication piece among families in the family court. Now, I know that the book dedicates proceeds to the Amanda Todd Legacy Society, which is amazing. Now, tell us, how do you see charitable organizations like the Amanda Todd Legacy Society working alongside family law systems to support affected individuals with this bullying and mental health?
Yeah, I think, you know, going back to that community piece and being aware of what's going on, and if you are a charitable organization that is really helping kids on the ground, which is what I liked about the Amanda Todd Legacy Society. Not only did I choose that place because of the fact that Amanda's story inspired me, the book is dedicated to her life. And so I decided to donate there, but I loved, you know, her mother is the one that runs that organization. And she also is a massive voice in the anti-bullying space these days. So I liked the fact that, you know, she was talking about how on the ground, the help is that this legacy society provides. And I think it is about, you know, the nitty gritty. You've got to get right down on the ground into the kids that are struggling locally in communities. And I think that's where maybe the family law piece comes in, and also with maybe local police officials and so forth, to have that connection as a charitable organization, so that if the police decide to do, you know, there's oftentimes, you know, the police as a general group will come out with some kind of anti-bullying campaign or some mental health campaign in some way. And then the charitable organizations can team up to have a greater impact. When it comes to the law professionals, again, if we could all be working together so that, you know, if it does get to that level where the law needs to get involved over something that happened, that zero tolerance attitude, you know, the charitable organizations are working with law enforcement. Law enforcement is working with, you know, police officials, and we're all in there together. And then lawyers are tied into there too. And then everyone can, you know, create that bigger impact with this zero tolerance attitude together.
Right, right. Let's talk about what's next for you, Katie Cooperman. What upcoming projects are in the pipeline for you? any more books down the line that are going to explore themes relevant to family law, mental health, or education?
Yeah, so I'm shifting gears a little bit. And my next book, which will be released in the summer, is going to be a children's book. And I am actually writing and illustrating it myself. So that's my exciting sort of fun project. I've taught myself to be an illustrator. And in this book, you know, similar themes, there is this piece. There's not too much bullying in there. There's one teeny incident that happens, but there is still this piece. There's this character that you're following through the book, and the character goes on about its day and various things happen. And the character is actually a bicycle wheel, and the wheel gets muddy, very muddy, just the way we all get muddy in life sometimes.
Right.
And so the message really is that lots of things are going to happen. You know, the mud might pile on, but what can we do to get clean again? There's always a way to get clean again and to start fresh, let's say. And so there's still these messages of, you know, standing up to unfair treatment, getting the help you need by speaking up, you know, even if you're shy or reclusive or hesitant, having that courage within you to just talk to the right person to get the help, to get clean. So that is my next project, and we'll see what happens after that one.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, amazing to have you with us. Thank you again for coming on. I'm going to throw Katie's bio down into the show notes, as well as a link for where the book can be purchased. It's on Amazon, Katie?
You got it.
Okay, perfect. And I'll also throw your website down in as well. If anyone wants to reach out to her for a guest speaker engagement or needs additional resources regarding bullying and mental health issues, definitely reach out. Thanks again so much for coming on today, Katie, and take care. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the Right Family Law Divorce Podcast. Remember, the information shared in our episodes is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal advice. Stay informed. Stay empowered. This is the Right Family Law Divorce Podcast.